Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Okay, welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends, as Keith has just pointed out in the chat at the side of this window. Welcome to another Word in Your Ear, brought to you by the miracle of two cocoa tins and a very long piece of string. And tonight we're delighted to be joined by Andy Neal, who's the author of an extraordinary piece of work about a music television program, that didn't last an awful long time, but has a legend that seems to far outstrip all the other music programs put together, pretty much. I can't imagine that any of the other music programs, even the ones that ran for 20, 30 years, could possibly justify such an extraordinary... Can I lift this huge...
Here it is.
Fabulous book.
Ready, steady, go. Required to lift it. But can we say, Dave, we must say that this is an absolutely fantastic... Allow us to gush. It's a fantastic book.
Yeah, just stand there. Just sit there for a minute, Andy. And we will gush. This is a magnificent piece of work, which is not surprising when you consider it took you an awful long time, didn't it? How long did it take you? How long have you been working on this project?
Just a mere 17 years. Not 17 years, like, consistently, like, working, you know, 24 hours a day. But I first got the idea for it back in 2003, and I said to Vicky Wickham, there needs to be a book on this show. It's the, you know, it's the elephant in the room. It's that thing that hasn't been done. We need to do it. And fast forward 17 years, we finally did it. And it didn't take too long, really.
But it's so comprehensive. You know, you've got tickets and ephemera and graphics and newspaper cuttings and letters to and from the musicians. I think you did, how was it, 100 interviews you did?
Yes, over 100, you know, from everybody from, you know, camera technicians to Mick Jagger and everybody in between. You know, it was a real labour of love. And whenever the opportunity presented itself, even though we didn't have a book deal, I thought, you know, you've got to grab these opportunities when you can. And that's what I did, basically.
So, right, for anybody who doesn't know, just tell us briefly the story of Ready, Steady, Go, when it started, how it got started, who were the key figures?
Well, it started quite inauspiciously, really, in 1980. There'd been on ITV, which was the channel that made Ready, Steady, Go and commissioned it. So it was basically a show that was originally going to be a news magazine program, a bit like the one show that we have now, of what, you know, a regional show serving London about events that were happening, you know, new plays opening, theatre shows, etc. And music was only really a small element of it, but the music thing was so popular and the dancing, the live audience that was such an integral part of it, that it just grew and grew and grew. And it became, by the end of sort of 63 into 64, the pop show in Britain. Nothing had really been like it. And it went right through until 1966.
And the shows that came before it, I'm not old enough to remember, I'm barely old enough to remember Ready, Steady, Go, but there were things like 6-5 Special and Oh Boy and Drumbeat and
yes.
Lucky Stars. Yeah. I mean, what did the creator and editor, Elkin Allen, what did he bring to Ready, Steady, Go that made it seem so different? Because those shows clearly felt they were kind of made by grown-ups, really.
Yes. Well, Elkin was obviously a grown-up too, but Elkin was quite a sort of quite an idiosyncratic sort of guy and had come from... a current affairs background. He was a journalist and he'd worked in all sorts of print media before moving into television once television really took off in the 50s. And he was very much against the sort of glitzy artifice that always, you know, the sort of the Lou Grade, Bell Parnell type of showbiz presentation. He wanted it to be more like, you know, a show with no frills, just like set in a very cramped setting, which happened to be a basement below Television House, where the show was filmed every week, with the audience right up close to the performer. And if the crowd mobbed the performer or the performer fell over, that was all considered fine because it was part of how it was. It was like all natural. And he was very much against, you know, putting somebody on a pedestal with a bit of tinsel behind them and where they're obviously miming. He just wanted it to be something that was totally against what had come before. And that was very, very much instrumental in how Ready, Steady, Go! Developed.
Now, it started in the heart of swinging London, didn't it? It was very near Holborn Tube Station. Tell us where it was.
It was Television House. The building, is funny enough, is actually still there, one of the few buildings that hasn't been knocked down in central London, just on the corner of Kingsway and Aldwych there. It was. It actually used to belong to the RAF, and Rediffusion ended up renting it from the RAF. And I'm not sure if they actually ever bought the freehold, but they rented it from them. And so all of Associated Rediffusion, which is how it was known then, which was the London area. It's a bit confusing to people who don't remember how the ITV regions worked in those days. Like, obviously, Granada was in Manchester and Liverpool, and you had Tyne Tees, which is Newcastle. Associated Rediffusion was London. And so basically that building on the corner of Aldwych and Kingsway was their headquarters. So you had all their offices there. You actually had the TV Times offices
Up
on the top floor, and the ITN News was done from there. So it was quite a big operation.
So I imagine, because as Mark has mentioned, this book is a miracle of photo research. I would imagine you did very well out of the fact that the TV Times was in the same building. Where they were down there taking pictures, were they? An awful lot of
that's
the
time. Right. They did. They had their own in-house guy. Oh, who's on this week? Oh, so-and-so, right, we'll go down and take photos. Not just of the performers, but of the crowd and the kids outside and, you know, everything, how it was put together.
So you've got an extraordinary treasury of photographs of everybody hanging about with everybody else backstage.
Exactly.
It's absolutely marvellous, the stuff you did.
That was the amazing thing when you actually see like all these like what we now consider like, you know, megastars, like everybody from the Beatles, Diana Ross, you know, whoever it may be, just literally, you know, when you see these photographs, like very stark black and white photos of just sitting or standing during rehearsals, having a cup of tea with the technicians, the guys with clipboards and that, just like, you know, like, and it was literally, there was no barriers, you know, there were dressing rooms, but 9 times out of 10, the performers just stayed there and watched the show, you know.
So who were the acts who were on it in the first series?
Well, I'll give you an example of the first show, the first ever performers to actually be on the show.
Was it Brian Poole and the Tremolos?
That's right. Yes, it was. I think it was their agent had managed to get them on there. And I think Billy Fury was the other one. He'd actually already been booked before the show had even been finalized. So, you know, it gives you an idea of the sort of pre-Beatles type of, you know, performer that was on there. And I think even Acker Bilk or somebody was on, and I'd need to refer back to it.
They had some jazz acts on that first show too.
Oh yeah, it was trad jazz was trad huge jazz, in 1962, 63. So it was a real sort of potpourri of different people, you know. And also it was people like Pat Boone who dropped into the studio to discuss his new film. You know, it was a real, as I said before, it was very much a news magazine type show. It wasn't strictly all pop at that point.
Really different early on was that they identified that it was the audience really that was just as important to some extent as the act, wasn't it? It was the dances. They went out to clubs, didn't they? To tell us about that, they recruited dancers in clubs and got them to appear on the show.
That's right. I mean, I think it goes back to Elkin Allen sort of wanting it to be very much, you know, as it was, and reflecting what was happening in London and the pop thing at the time. So instead of going and hiring professional dancers, you know, or getting, you know, the renter crowd in, they would literally just go to the ballrooms and to some of the clubs that were opening in London, like the Scene Club and the Flamingo Club in Soho. And they would go down there. And even if they weren't particularly good dancers, if they had a look or there was something about them, you know, you'd be a tap, tap, tap on the shoulder. What are you doing next Friday? Will you come down and rehearse?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And that's how it was. It was very, you know, there was an egalitarian type thing to it. You know, there was no like, sort of like, oh, well, you know, he's not going to look good on camera. We'll have to get somebody that, you know, will look good on camera. It was just whoever they thought looked interesting.
But it is remarkable how many of the people who became famous on the program via the program had no previous experience whatsoever, did they? I mean, they just kind of blundered into it, didn't they?
Oh, very much so. And again, credit must go to Elkin Allen again for just like, you know, you imagine what television's like now. I mean, things have loosened up a bit, but in those days, you know, Associated Reader Fusion was run by guys who served in the Royal Navy.
Yes.
So to actually let the lunatics take over the asylum was actually quite a brave, you know, well, I think they just basically said to Elkin Allen, you get on with it. We don't want to know. And, you know, you're only answerable to us if something seriously goes wrong. So Elkin Allen, you know, by rights would have said, okay, we need a safe pair of hands here. We need to get people with experience. And he didn't, he hired his secretary. You know, when he was dictating the memo for the first program, he said to his secretary, Vicky Wickham, you know, take a note. And she started noting down all these things. She put down her pen and pad and said, Elkin, I must work on the show. And her previous musical knowledge was like South Pacific and, you know, the musicals that her parents played. She had no knowledge of pop music, rock and roll.
But she was incredibly connected, wasn't she? I mean, she's big friends with Dusty and Madeline Bell and a big soul fan. She was the one who's responsible largely for black soul music.
True, but that came later. I mean, she literally, by her own admission, had absolutely no idea of how she was going to go about this, how to compile a chart, how to book the acts. It literally was like learning on the hop. The same thing with, you know, some of the other people that came in later, like, you know, for example, Michael Lindsay Hogg, the director, he'd only done one play for Irish television. He just, in the days when you could lie, he didn't have to sort of show a detailed CV. He just walked into Reader Fusion, said, oh, I've done this, 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 and this, and said, okay, you start on Friday, you know. And he literally was just, you know, winging it, really.
So the person who's on the cover of the book is obviously Kathy McGowan. How did Kathy McGowan end up on the programme as the presenter, as the main face?
Well, the show had been going for, I think, roughly 2 months, and, you know, it was getting good ratings, but it was very much that the presenter of the show was a Radio Luxembourg DJ who also worked for the BBC, Keith Fordyce. Now, it doesn't sound ancient now, but in 1963, like, Keith Fordyce was 34, which was considered over the hill.
He's really old, I remember. Yeah, go on.
He looked old.
He did.
And so for a show that was sort of like trying to appeal to a teenage audience, it was almost like sort of like having the older benefactor at the kids' party, making sure that nobody was getting out of hand. It didn't quite have the effect that Elkin Allen was looking for. So he decided that, okay, we're going to hold auditions to find a young teenage male and also a young teenage female who was sort of like, you know, a typical teenage mod or teenager that can sort of, the kids can readily identify with. So they put adverts in the Melody Maker and Stage and a few other magazines that, you know, entertainment business magazines to you know, hold auditions for the people that they were looking for. And literally hundreds of people, I've got the figure in the book, but I think it was something like 500 kids just descended on Kingsway, and eventually they whittled them down to 10 people. And among those people that auditioned, incidentally, was Annie Nightingale.
Yes.
You know, who eventually went to work for Associated Reader Fusion. And Kathy was one of the last few remaining ones. And apparently, you know, she was pretty bad on her camera test by all accounts. But, and she actually, you know, from an account she gave at the time, she thought she'd done badly, and she while she was waiting to do another camera test or something, she got up and left, thinking she'd blown her big moment. And Elkin Allen said, you know, sit down, love, you know, it's not over yet, type of thing. And, you know, lots of people sort of, no, she'll never work. But again, Elkin Allen said, no, I think she'll need a lot of work, but she's got what it takes. And, you know,
so what was it that she had, you think, that worked so well? Why did she connect so powerfully with people?
I think because she wasn't one of these professionals playing at being a teenager. She was a gawky, shy, the sort of person that
was like a particularly hip member of the audience who just happened to be on stage.
Not even really hip, just somebody that was like a typical fan who would gush and go weak at the knees interviewing Paul McCartney or Dave Clark, or, you know, she always wanted Cliff Richard, who was her favourite, to be on the show.
And he never no, I never knew that.
I don't know if I'm misquoting this, but I was looking at it last night. Doesn't she do an interview with Mick Jagger where she actually passes on to people? People want to know how often you take a bath.
Yeah, how often you wash your hair. That was pretty much the litmus test for her interviews.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, you know, how did you get that guitar sound?
No, absolutely.
No, it was like, you know, how often do you have a bath?
Yeah. That's what people
want. And Mick, God bless him,
He answered.
Yeah, it's very strange. Tell us about the part it played in Swinging London, you know, because the tagline was "The weekend starts here," and I was watching it up in Wakefield, and there wasn't much of a weekend happening in Wakefield, but it was the centre of Swinging London, isn't it? It's where everybody came together on Friday night because it was in the West End. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, geographically, it was perfectly positioned for all of that. I mean, even artists who weren't on the show that week would just drop in at, you know, 5:45, go up to the green room, get a drink, because it was a free bar, which was another incentive to go there.
Right.
And, you know, literally all the sort of the epicenter of Swinging London would go up there. So there'd be everyone.
David Hockney,
You know, Kenneth Tynan from The Observer, all sorts of people would literally rub shoulders with the Don Ardens and the Mickey Mosts and the Kit Lamberts and the Brian Epsteins, because it was where you would sort of like catch up on all the gossip and, you know, when's your record coming out, what have you. And then once the show had gone off the air, they'd come up for a bit, you know, have a few more drinks afterwards, and then they'd all go off to some swank.
There'd be a party in Albert Colgan's flat.
That's right. Yeah, or go to the Ad Lib Club in Leicester Square, Leicester Place. So it literally was the place where the weekend would start, you know.
So when did it move? It moved to Wembley, didn't it? At what point did it move?
Well, the show had been going for like 2 years, roughly, by that point, and it was starting to get a little bit into a rut, and Elkin Allen could see that it needed something to sort of reboot it, because he was very much going back to how he wanted everything to be very much, unadorned and warts and all. He didn't like miming. He really didn't like, you know, like, for example, you know, Sandy Shaw walking around that little studio in Kingsway with her record that had like, you know, a 20-piece orchestra and backing singers and, you know, where it's just her miming like a goldfish to a record. He wanted an actual live performance, and he wanted it to be like a review, like a stage review. So like, you know, Kathy would introduce the act, they would plug in, they would play, and then you'd swing the camera over to the other side of the studio, and there would be PJ Proby with an orchestra, you know, with a backing singer, with a backing group. So, of course, with a small basement studio in Kingsway, there's no way they could do it there. So he basically went to the powers that be at Rediffusion and said, I've got this idea. Let's move to a bigger studio. Let's do it all live. You know, let's get sound technicians in. Let's, you know. And they went with it. And so they moved out of the centre of London, which to many people actually sort of killed the vibe, really, because it was like a club. And now you're moving up to a much bigger studio.
Yeah.
And of course, in some ways it was interesting because now it was like this brave new world of television where it was literally going to be like a live performance. But that intimacy and that sort of, you know, that sort of one-to-one thing that had happened in Kingsway was lost. So while something was gained with the live performance, something was lost. And even though it carried on for like another year and a half, it was sort of like the beginning of the end, really, for the show, which is ironic, really.
Who do you think were the most memorable live performances in terms of actually playing live?
Well, I think Vicky would always talk to Michael. You know, she'd say, okay, these guys are very good live. I've seen them at the Marquee. I've seen them at, you know, wherever it may be, at the Flamingo. So there was always the acts that you would expect, people like, you know, Georgie Fame and the Blue Flames, Manfred Mann, guys who'd sort of come from sort of jazz R&B background who are good musicians. But also she liked the ones where, you know, that people that, you know, were good live acts. I mean, the Stones being an obvious example, and of course The Who. I mean, you know, there's a great story in there where, like, you know, The Who would do a sound check and send the technicians running out with their hands over their ears because they didn't know how to literally cope with, like, 4x12 Marshall stat, 8x12.
Sure.
And, you know, the Yardbirds, of course, all the people you'd expect who had good musicians in the band. And, of course, it also sorted the men out from the boys for the people that, you know, made good records in the studio but weren't necessarily good at reproducing it. In fact, in the Raver column, in the Melody Maker, there are a lot of snide asides, you know, to, you know, what will Dave Clark do now that Ready Steady Go is completely live? You know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Because basically a lot of these records were done with session people. And so now you're going to have to try and reproduce them with just your band, you know, live on a you know, on a television show. Are you up to it? And a lot of them weren't. You know, there were some real disasters on the show. Yeah.
What about those times when there are quite a few occasions when the big American kind of soul acts came over?
Yes.
And kind of took it over pretty much, didn't they? Yeah. Tell us about that.
Well, that, again, the first example of that was the Tamla Motown special, which was filmed in the Ready Steady Go studio. It wasn't strictly part of Ready Steady Go, but it was the same production team. And that was pretty much a dry run to see, you know, and again, it was Vicky going to Elkin Allen with the idea of saying, listen, you know, promoters bringing the Tamla Motown package over, you know, why don't we do a show or a television special around it, you know, where we just devoted all to these acts that pretty much were, you know, apart from the Supremes and Mary Wells, Tamla Motown, they had none of the acts had a big hit apart from those ones I've just mentioned. You know, nobody really knew Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. You know, songs like, you know, You Really Got a Hold on Me, more people knew them from the Beatles.
They
didn't really know the originals. And same with, you know, the Four Tops and Stevie Wonder, you know, like Fingertips, which was a big record in the clubs, wasn't a hit. So again, you know, fair play to Elkin Allen. He said to Vicky, okay, you can do it, but we'll need a star name to present it. And Vicky said, no problem, I'll get Dusty, because, you know, Dusty has played with these guys, they're her friends, it won't be a problem. And it wasn't. And that special, The Sound of Motown, I think was absolutely instrumental in really furthering the cause of Motown and black American music in Britain. So once that had been a success and it had got people's interest going, then they could say, okay, right, well, let's do a show around James Brown. Now, the James Brown one was really...
And there was a big reaction to that, was that a lot of people just couldn't, a lot of the audience just couldn't deal with it.
That was just almost a step too far. I mean, because again, nobody had really heard of James Brown. I mean, he was a big name in the clubs and all the mods loved him, and, you know, Ready Steady Go played his records as incidental music on the show. But, you know, to devote a half an hour to his stage show with, you know, and what a stage show with the, you know, just the, you know, the infamous Please Please Me, where he collapses and there's one of the famous flames comes out and drapes the, you know. So if you can imagine mum and dad watching with their children at 6 o'clock.
Yeah, it's quite early in the evening.
It was. And in those days too, another thing that's interesting, which you don't get now with your 100 channels of, you know, certain channel surfing, is that the ratings were really important in those days. So if you were tuned into ITV at 6 o'clock, generally people tended to stay on that channel for the rest of the evening. They, you know, sometimes they might switch over to the BBC. So there's a real ratings thing to try and
lure
people in at 6 o'clock.
Yeah, like breakfast show on radio.
Right through, you know, right through up past the watershed, etc. So to see somebody like James Brown at 6 o'clock, you know, you can just see people reaching for the, you know, they didn't have remotes in those days, reaching over to turn the, my children aren't watching this, you know, I won't say some words that were used. And I saw some of the letters that were pouring into, like, you know, the television, you know, TV Times, and to the music papers, and to the regional television newspapers.
Say what kind of thing?
Oh, just, well, you know, who let this, why devote half an hour to this drivel?
Yeah.
Man sounds like he's having an epileptic fit, and he is having an epileptic fit, and my children, you know, I'll let them go and see, you know.
I mean, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because it was quite radical, strange music put right in the middle of the road, wasn't it, in terms of TV programming?
It
wasn't parked away at 11 o'clock at night.
No, it wasn't. This is the thing. It was almost like Vicky was almost like a zealot in a way, wanting to turn people on to this music or at least expose them to it.
But also, you forget this is family viewing, isn't it? Because, you know, all households only had one TV.
One television.
Yeah. This is a program aimed at teenagers, but if they're going to watch it, the whole family's going to watch it.
And you can see kids saying to them, oh, please, can we watch Radio City? Oh, okay. And pretty much how I've described it, pretty much fed into how Top of the Pops really became the ratings winner and sort of won the battle, because something like James Brown and Ready Steady Go at 6 o'clock on a Friday tea time was too avant-garde for a lot of people, and Top of the Pops was much more safe in that respect, where your mum, dad, granddad, you know, everybody could sit around and watch, you know, a popular show where you had everything from, oh, you know, this week The Who move in with My Generation, and now we've got Ken Dodd with Tears, or the Seekers with The Carnival Is Over. Ready City Go that was anathema to Ready City Go. They wouldn't do that. It was like, okay, we've got James Brown, and now we're going to have a new band we've just discovered, you know, like The Creation, or, you know, The Move, or, you know, it was literally like, it didn't have to be in the charts, and the band didn't necessarily...
Well, they got Donovan on before he'd even, I think, released a record, didn't they?
Exactly, and that was the power of Ready, Steady, Go.
Incredible.
You know, like, the guy who at the time was the program editor had seen Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones had said to him, like, come and see this young folk singer who's just cutting demos in Denmark Street. So he went down there and he was doing, you know, all the sort of Mississippi John Hurt stuff, you know, and the Woody Guthrie stuff. And he said, I also write my own songs. But, you know, they said, okay, we're like, we'll try something. We'll put you on the show for consecutive weeks and let's see how you go. And it literally made Donovan a household name.
And he went from being a kind of busker, really, didn't he? A kind of traveling busker.
Sleeping on the beach down at Tonight.
Overnight. Exactly.
I was reading the bit today where... You know, it really was, let's do the show right here. I think the Troggs auditioned in reception, didn't they?
That's right.
They come downstairs, we've got a couple of bands, they're playing in reception, and we're trying to decide which one to put on the programme. And the Troggs won that little contest, and we're on the programme. So why did it finish? And at the point that it did, so it's quite early, right at the end of 1966, I think I'm right in saying, is when it finishes.
It's quite uncanny when you know looking back on it how it finished when it did, because it was just as the scene was changing, you know, like, you know, the business, the rock business was starting, and the British beat boom, that, you know, with all the British invasion groups had sort of been and gone, and now we were coming into that second wave with Jimi Hendrix and Cream, who, you know, were on those last shows of Ready, Steady, Go. I think the reason it finished really was because, I mean, Elkin Allen had wanted to take it off actually earlier at the end of he thought that, you know, he was one of these guys who, you know, didn't want it to outstay its welcome. He felt that he'd achieved what he'd set out to achieve.
Quite rightly.
We could do with a bit more of that in television, though.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And he sort of wanted it to go out in a blaze of glory. And so he sort of left the show, and a new program controller came in. And so they tried to find a replacement for it. They couldn't really find an adequate replacement for it. So it sort of had a stay of execution for another year. But within that year, 1966, you know, so much was changing, you know, like all this, the new groups that I mentioned were coming in, and the industry, you know, the writing was on the wall. And I think Ready, Steady, Go, you know, it had been on for 3.5 years. Top of the Pops was now the main show, you know, all the polls for in the NME and the Melody Maker and Record Mirror, you know, favorite, you know, pop show. Ready, Steady, Go was finishing second to Top of the Pop. So it was, by then it had been outpaced. So it was sort of really, you know, again, I guess it was with hindsight. And funny enough, when I was researching the book, when you read the letters to the editor, in the music papers I just mentioned, it's all there was so much like, well, Ready Steady Go, you know, should have been taken off, you know, months ago. And there's all these people like, you know, Joe, who is Joe Tex? We've never heard of him. Why is there a whole show to the Who where they're smashing their gear? It was a real sort of like anti-feeling. And then, ironically, in 1967, you start seeing these letters start cropping up with increasing.
Can they bring Ready Steady Go back?
Can they bring it back?
Yeah, they can bring it back.
Yeah. Can you see its influence? Because I mean, you look at programs like The Tubes, a really good example, actually. The Tubes seem to be very, very based on it. Live action and people just milling around the stage, and it felt like a club, you know, the interaction.
But even before that, you know, even with Mike Mansfield's Supersonic to a degree. Yeah. That was a bit more sort of blitzy, and it had dry ice, and the audience was sort of further away from the performers. And, they didn't have as diverse a selection of acts that City Go had, because obviously it was a different scene. But, you know, there were attempts to do that. And, of course, Mickey Mouse Revolver Show, you know, hosted by Peter Cook, you know, in the punk era, you know, that was another example of, you know, having bands playing live on a stage with kids up close. But I think you're right. The first one to really try to, you know, tap into the essence of what Ready Steady Go was, The Tube, having it go out live at 6 o'clock on an ITV channel, you know, with a young guy and a young girl presenter and with all sorts of cock-ups happening live on TV and what have you. And the guys that made The Tube, you know, Jeff Wanfor and Malcolm Gary, both readily admit that they were heavily influenced by City Go. They used to watch it on Time Tees back in the day, and you know, it rubbed off on them.
And so, the fact that it was live, that was the exciting thing. It's live and things can go wrong, you know. Like Ready Steady Go. Rod Stewart's first appearance of Ready Steady Go, he's so drunk he fell down a ladder, I think.
That's right. Luckily, he was only mine.
Has it survived? I mean, are there recordings of it all? Or has it lots of it been wiped? Or what's happened to it all?
Unfortunately, lots of it were wiped at the time. You know, it's the old story. Tape was expensive. They used to tape it. And, you know, there's a good story in the book about the James Brown special we've been talking about, where the engineers recorded it. And after the show went off the air, everybody grabbed a drink and came into the James Brown and the Famous Flames, all the production people, and watched the show back. And once it had gone out around the various regions, the tape came back to Reader Fusion. They thought, okay, well, there's a gardening program we need to record. We'll just wipe it. You know?
And but the guy who bought the tapes early on was Dave Clark, wasn't it?
That's so right.
Dave Clark, to some extent, is the kind of owns the controls the legacy of Ready Steady Go.
Well, he was quite. I mean, the story about how he got the tapes. You know, how long have we got? But in a nutshell, some shows were kept because they thought that, you know, for example, the ones that the Beatles starred in, and there was one that had featured the Rolling Stones. Reader Fusion had world, you know, there was a company called Global Television that represented Associated Reader Fusion's overseas interests, and they thought that they could perhaps sell the show overseas. So some of those shows escaped the purge because they thought that they could perhaps do something with them or enter them into television festivals, etc. So those ones were kept. When this company, Global Television, who were storing basically all of what was left of Associated Reader Fusion, Reader Fusion holdings, when they went out of business, they had all these tapes. Basically, you know, Global Television sold these tapes to Dave Clark, and Dave Clark sat on them for something like 10 years throughout the 70s. You saw the odd clip here and there. He was sort of, you know, teasing, you know, there'd be the odd teaser here and there. And then eventually he put them out in the 80s. But the problem is that he, you know, there's only 9 shows out of 173, which is just sad. It's just sad when you see that's a small percentage that survived. You know, they do survive complete, and I just wish that he or BMG or whoever control the usage of the program now would let us see the shows as they were, you know, as nature intended. Yeah. Because, you know, I mean, Dave Clark, from a business point of view, he thought, okay, compilations are the way to go, and he sort of dissected them. And, you know, they at least, you know, you're seeing some of the performances on there, but I just love to see them as they were. So you get an idea of like how it went. It was so ramshackle, you know, like cameras in vision, cameras mowing down some of the dancers who weren't quick enough to get out of the way. You know, some of the performers had to mime on a small trolley. And when the song starts, these kids start to yank the trolley away. These performers end up on the floor, you know, almost. It's live on television.
Well, it'd be lovely to see the whole thing. It'd be lovely to see it with the adverts, actually, as well, because that would very much remind you of the time. But until that day, if you want to know what you could be seeing, because at the back of this fantastic book, you've got a log of absolutely all of the...
Every
single program, everybody who appeared. But honestly, Mark and I are just going to briefly gush just about the sheer quality of the job that you, and no doubt some other people, have done on this book, because you very often see books that are fabulous, full of pictures. Now, and I just find they're very nice, but I get bored with them after I've gone through them once. This is not the case with this book at all, because it's just stacked full of remarkable pictures, which are properly scaled so you can see who's in the damn picture, which is the mistake that people so often make. And as we were saying before we came on air, there's an informative caption on every single picture.
It's incredible. And the detail, the letters written to the musicians and, you know,
everything.
It's just
honestly, if you want to get the nearest thing to an idea of what it must have been like to be in the centre of the swinging 60s, it really is in that book. It's absolutely extraordinary.
We couldn't recommend it more highly.
You find somebody to buy this for you for Christmas. And suggest that if you when you finish reading it, you use it as a weightlifting. if you're going to load it in each corner,
that's right.
It's not just a coffee table book; it's a coffee table itself. Really is, honestly, and it's terrific. It's really terrific piece of work.
We were knocked out with it.
We really were, and
you can now see why it took 17 years, can't you?
I can. It's lovingly
well
done.
Spent.
It really is remarkable. So, thanks very much for talking to us about it.
And thank you, David, and thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure, and I hope it's a book that people will just keep going back to years and years from now, because, as I said, Ready, Steady, Go, you know, it was only one show like it, and it hadn't been documented, and it needed to be documented, and it was a labour of love, and it you know, it demanded nothing less, and there it is for future generations.
It's terrific. Every home should have one.
Absolutely.
Thanks, guys.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.